Get your films on with the Blurgs.
Once an idea has taken hold of the brain, it's almost impossible to eradicate.
Unpacking movies has never been more spot on, woke, fire, and just plain lit.
They are lit all the time.
So if you're unsure whether or not to plop down some cash for a film, check out the Blurgs.
When a man with a 45 meets a man with a rifle, the man with a pistol is a dead man.
Brando's got what plants crave.
It's got electrolytes.
You really only need to hang, mean bastard. But mean bastards, you need to hang.
Don't say you weren't warned. Ridiculous. Here's Brandon and Jeff.
To our special third anniversary, goddamn, third anniversary of the Film Blurs. We still covering pandemic movies, you know, for every anniversary. So expect one next year. We already know what we're doing next year. Anyways, my name is Brandon Nord, a.k.a. Hero Protagonist, a.k.a. the true father of Joe and Kanye's kids, a.k.a. Poppy Chulo, still sticking Molly up there, all the women in your lives' butt and eating all your Jello, a.k.a. the Glizzy King, extra sloppy and beefy, a.k.a. Mr. Krusty, a.k.a. the Lethal Protector, a.k.a. my biggest pet peeve is sports because I don't like seeing grown men sweat on each other. A.K.A. I want a Subaru Outback with mad strippers in the back giving shape-ups. A.K.A. Ruff McGruff. Blow out your kneecaps and steal your drug money. A.K.A. D's Nuts. And A.K.A. B-Wood, the Mob D. Call me your messiah. And I'm joined here today, as always, with...
Hello, this is Jeff Stewart, A.K.A. Uncle Jeffrey, A.K.A. J. Otis Dynamite, A.K.A. Revengeman Button. He who remains Petty Ruxpin, Jobu Tupaki,
Little Tom,
this motherfucker, to be determined, Black Giovanni Ribisi, Chocolate Tarantino, Ebony Spielberg. I didn't know we were doing the intros. I had to look them all up real quick.
Me too. We got so many AKAs.
And we just
anyways, we are joined here by some real special guests who just we. They hear our ignorant shit and like, yo, what the fuck's wrong with these two?
I'm here for it.
Gentlemen, introduce yourself. Let's start with Carl. Go ahead.
My name is Chris Davenport, a.k.a. Cal, a.k.a. the Haribo Killer, a.k.a. the Jersey. No, I'm just kidding. Just call me Cal. How y'all doing? And we got my man over there.
Go ahead, Vice. Shit. Introduce yourself.
This is your man, Vice Victus Vice, a.k.a. Big Eddie Plantain, a.k.a. Sherman Crunk. What's going on?
I need a list. I didn't know a.k.a.'s were in order.
Too. I was prepared for that shit.
I love it.
All right. And we here giving you the definitive fucking discussion podcast on Tenet. It just got re-released. Three of us managed to see it in IMAX. Our guests have been ride or die for this movie since it dropped. And it took me a while, right? It took me a while for obvious reasons. So, like, I mean, Jeff, I know it took you a while, too. I don't know how you feel on it still.
Look, if we're going to jump into it, seeing it in IMAX 70 millimeter, that's the way to go. It's an experiential movie. And I enjoyed it better seeing it that way than I ever could have on TV. Still, I have my issues with it, but now I can see what Nolan was doing, and it's a better film to me after seeing it big and having some time away from it, because we spent so much time clowning this movie and like all the bullshittery that happens with the release and everything.
Yeah, man, because you know what? That shit pissed me off, bro. I'm like, yo, y'all motherfuckers gonna put this shit out during, like, prime time where they're telling you, yo, you go, you probably gonna die. And then at the point, like, I remember me and you, Jeff, we watched it, and we're like, we didn't go to theater to see it, but we were just like, bro, y'all decide to drop this movie now instead of, like, if you were gonna pull that shit. I was like, yo, y'all are better off pulling that shit with Wonder Woman.
I'm sorry, I hate to cut you off. I think the problem though is at that point they could only use the ammunition that they had, you know what I mean? Like, because they couldn't go out and make that film in summer of 2020. They couldn't have done any of that. They had that and I thought about it. I thought about when that film hit theaters and the response that it got and the confusion that it got, I wondered what it would have been like if that, not that it came out right now, but like at a time where people were able to maybe go to a see the trailer in a theater or have those conversations. I remember being surprised that people wanted to go see Memento with me. That felt like the mind fuck that people wouldn't want to go see in theaters, right. And people ended up loving that film. I'm not saying they're the same film, but I wonder if because everybody was kind of locked in the home and having certain conversations about this film, it hampered a lot of that stuff, because this couldn't have been a Wonder Woman. It was a tentpole film because this is the money that they spent, but it was not, it's a very challenging film to try and use as something that's going to keep your company in the black for another year.
It may be another Nolan film, and I might be misremembering this, but didn't they have a whole entire thing on Fortnite?
Fortnite.
They did?
Yeah, that's
shit. Yeah, right. A lot of Fortnite
and that's
promo.
What really kind of pissed me off, right? Like, I'm petty like that. I'm petty fucking Ruxpin. Like, yeah.
Put that in the AKA.
I missed it. Like, it's actually here. It felt pandering, right? It felt like they were grasping for straws. Because this is not a movie for the Fortnite crowd. But they were just trying to grab that money.
Oh, hell no.
Right? Yes. That's what this whole entire thing felt like for me. Like, a money grab.
And you know what? It left a bad taste in my mouth because I was just like, yo, this is the first original big blockbuster movie, not based on a book or a comic book, to have a black lead. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. From the biggest director in the world. And I was like, oh, y'all going to put it out now?
Yeah.
Where? I did see it on the opening weekend. You know, it was like me and like two other people. So it was a very strange experience because, as you mentioned, the movie itself is a very unusual type of vibe, type of film. To be that big budget, but still be a kind of a this weird contained spy film, whatever it is. And, well, just some background for people who don't know. So I got my start kind of in this scene, as it were. My forte is war films from an international perspective. I was in the Army for a long time. And while I was deployed, I started writing about films, TV, and stuff like that. So and through the years, and I was overseas for a good amount of my service, like 10 years almost, basically straight up overseas. So my kind of background slash point of view is that having seen war films from different countries and how the nations represent themselves in these films, the same way we do, like, you know, like people like clown Michael Bay film, for example, like that's speaking to our id for, you know, as much as we love or hate it. And other countries do the same thing in turn, like Indian films or Chinese blockbusters. So as I was watching, as I kind of absorbed Tenet, I was like, yeah, for one, it's a very strange to kind of have that you have this kind of what ends up being a espionage slash war film, you know, play all the time travel, all the sci-fi shit going on also, but I kind of have that as like this big tentpole. It's a very unusual move. Like even in optimal conditions, like if the pandemic never happened, anything like that, if it still came out, like, you know, on its prime time summer blockbuster, people would be like, what the fuck is going on? Like it's such a strange kind of gambit to go through. So I felt that, you know, during the pandemic, during the opening weekend, but so I was kind of mixed on it to begin with. But as time went on, and again, as kind of we, I don't want to say normalized, because nothing is normal anymore after the fucking pandemic. But as we kind of got back up to speed, as it were, and other films and the world at large continued to get crazier, I actually kind of dug that the movie kind of fits in the vibe of the madness we're all in now. Like it's kind of this weird confusing miasma of political, social, you know, and quagmire that we're all in. So, like, not just seeing it again after the fact in the IMAX, but just, like, experiencing it again, like, I saw it at home and it came out on HBO Max. Like, just over time, over the past few years, it really does, I won't say it's prescient, but, like, it kind of, I guess time caught up with it, with how strange it is. So now, when I saw it recently again on IMAX, it kind of all cemented that, yeah, this is, like, definitely a blockbuster of our time, for our time. We just kind of didn't know it yet. So, you know, the time travel, shit going on.
Right.
yeah, that's well, okay. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I think the funny thing you mentioned a couple times in a couple different parts right there, Vice. You said the word vibe, and that's what hooked me from the beginning. I mean, I because it was a pandemic and I was working at Complex at the time, I didn't get any interviews for this film until the home release around like December. So I got my hands on the Blu-ray. And after watching the behind the scenes and, you know, getting ready for the interviews I had to do, I watched the film and with subtitles because I heard that the theater experience was terrible with audio. And I do want to know what it was like in IMAX, if it was still the parts where it was muddled. But it was one of those films where, like, because I didn't care as much about, like, having to know who each individual person was or really try and, like, wrap my brain around what the inversion asked. Like, I understood it as a concept, but I didn't try and get too deep into it. That movie just flows. Like, at one, they're rappelling up buildings, they're flipping cars over, then he's realizing, oh shit, I'm in the car. Like, he's talking to somebody that's talking backwards, and then he's answering questions that the guy didn't ask. Like, there's so much going on in that film that is just, like, there to fuck with you. But if you just sit there and really watch that film, it's fun. It's straightforward. Like, what happens, and you see it happen once, and then you see it happen again, and you understand why it happened, and you get to the point. Like, it's very basic in that aspect, but it's, I think, with a lot, that's why I mentioned people having certain conversations in the pandemic. I don't want to go too crazy, but we had a lot of time to ruminate on things, especially if you saw a trailer. Maybe you were working from home. You didn't have a water cooler to kind of have discussions about, especially with people who may or may not know different things that you know. So I think people got really on the idea of what the time inversion is and traveling back. And I tried to understand it. If you watch the featurette and they show you, like, you know, the damn screens that they had to have set up backstage, so you knew we are at this point and this person is moving here while this is going here. Like, yeah, it's fucking confusing. Don't worry about it. It just catch a vibe and roll with it.
Yeah. It reminds me of Miami Vice where it's just dudes on a mission and you just vibe out and go with it. You know what I mean? Because Miami Vice also gets lost in the sauce, but eventually I just, like, yo, I don't give a fuck. I'm enjoying this shit.
Exactly.
My favorite part of the movie had nothing to do with the inversion bullshit, though. Like, if you take out the time travel aspect of it, it is the third best Bond film we've never got. Like,
facts.
Yep. So and then even watching it in IMAX is like, yeah, this spectacle is great, it's fantastic, but it's confusing, and I just want to see more, like, spy shit, right? Like, I want to excise this whole entire moving backwards and forward shit, and I want Black Bond to fight Maximilian Zorn, aka, like, bad Russian accent, you know, like,
Boris. Ooh. I call him Boris from Rocky Bull.
I want to take a quick tangent on that, because actually me and Brandon spoke about this recently when we met up. So kind of a little bit related to this. So people were talking about who's going to be the new Bond, and people were saying they want a Black Bond, you know, Idris Elba or whatever. Or there's a guy, Soapy DeRiso. He's been coming up, upcoming star. He's in Gangs in London. And let's change it up. Let's do a Black Brit, whatever. Let's keep him British. And so I thought about that, and I was like, what I thought was that sounds good on paper, but then when you think about who Bond is, he's a agent of the state. He has qualified immunity to the max. He kills for the Queen without recompense, and he's doing it to, like, in a broader sense, continue the empire of Britain, whatever it is now. And I always thought people, like, they were like, you want that representation, quote unquote, is nice, but what's actually happening if you put a Black man as the agent of state that to prolong the empire? So I said about that, because people never thought, I don't think that people think through that scenario too much. So in this case, then, where you have, you know, Denzel Jr., like, he's a CIA agent, you know, as far as we can tell in the beginning. So you have a similar problem here, or similar issue, or what people say problematic. It's still, you know, a Black cop, more or less, quote unquote, right? But then what we like about it, what I enjoy as it happens, that they say this in the movie, that he goes, once he enters the world of the tenant, he kind of goes beyond the borders, goes beyond the allegiance. It's not allegiance to a country or a specific, like, state or nation. It's, as they say, save the world. And you see in the movie all this kind of, you see his allies, these international, this collective kind of come together to fight the future. So it's like, so I really like that spin. Like, so him as a Black Bond, it's not just Black James Bond doing the same James Bond shit. Like, it is a top flight spy, but it's like, it goes beyond that at a kind of almost ideological level of like, no, he's going to save the world and you're going to team up with this international legal crew of like, you know, high tech goons to do it. So yeah, I like that even though I doubt, no one thought of that forehead about the implications of Black Bond, but just having this, the protagonist that kind of represent this, like kind of this higher level of beyond these, our petty squabbles. It's like, you know, it's the more like virtuous kind of say fight. So yeah, I read that part.
And I honestly never thought about the implications of having a Black James Bond. I mean, I just never thought it would happen because, you know, white people.
right? Facts.
But yeah. Like him as, you know, a super cop working for the colonizers. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's stop all that noise right now.
I'm not saying about it. You know, it's fair. You know, it's because he's still at the same time. He's a power fantasy. He's meant to be like, no. He's an impossible standard. That, you know. So you know, whatever. Instead, the dream is still alive. It's like, I'm just saying, like, when you think about it in depth or the implication of it, I like that we have an alternative, if you will, of the protagonist, you know, fighting for the future in the past, whatever, all that shit.
Well, let's jump right into it. I want to point this out. When the opening WB logo opens, the first thing you hear is Travis Scott's voice backwards. And that's a motif that they put in throughout the movie where halfway through, because the story goes forward in times, and then once you get to the halfway point, it goes backwards. When it goes backwards, then they play his voice forwards throughout the movie. Every time he discovers something new or does some cool shit, you hear Travis's voice.
I didn't realize it was, I got to rewatch it again now. Goddamn.
So when they say wake up the Americans and you hear that, that's Travis's voice.
Where you first see the protagonist. To a Ludwig Göransson. You know, he's a previous composer, Oscar composer. Hell now. Yeah. You know, like, yeah, like we keep discovering how genius he is. So I remember he did the score for Creed, the original, the first Creed for Coogler, and it was so cool. Like the soundtrack, like the percussions, it's literally punches. He went to a boxing gym. He had them like guy just like doing like boxing work, footwork stuff. He recorded the punches, the punches in a bag, the footwork sound, the shuffling, and he mixed that shit into the percussion of the score. But, like the sound is literally what you hear is punches. Yo, this man, he's another level, man. Shit.
Yeah, that.
I mean, he learned a lot producing for hip hop artists. Yeah,
that's a
man.
Good. That's a talented white guy. That's a real talented white guy.
there's a few of them out there. It's a couple.
So, the opera siege, right? That's what this movie opens on. So just to set this up for everybody, because I know this is like, even the opening is hard to parse out. They're all there to get a piece of what we find out eventually is the algorithm. So Sater has his men planted there. The Ukrainian government is also there trying to get it. And they're using this terrorist siege as cover, which is pretty cool because all that gunfire and shit and people are, all those civilians are like, yeah, nobody's gonna be paying attention when there's a splinter group that goes off, you know, and tries to extract this dude. Vice, you said it best when we met up, where this gives you, this opening scene gives you everything you need to know about our protagonist, even though we learn more about him as the movie goes on, like how empathetic he is. Like first thing he says, he's like, yo, listen, you got to come with me now or I got to kill you. Either way, he's like, I'd rather be the first option.
I'm sorry. He did the same thing towards the end of this scene where, like, you know, all this stuff's going on with him. And one of the first things he asked me is like, what happened to my team? Is my team okay? Right.
Yep.
When he finds the other part of the plan or the cover is the bombs, he's like, you know what? He's like, I'm switching it up, you know, like call an audible. I'm getting the bombs now. Get him out of here. And like, it's not part of the mission. My mission now. Like, you know, he's about it.
Yeah.
He's about this life. And yeah. So like,
yeah, man. He doesn't want innocent people getting caught up, which is funny because we'll get into that later because somebody innocent does get caught up. And I'm like, well, bro, like, And that's what I love about the whole movie. Is like he spends the once he realizes he fucked up, he spends the rest of the movie trying to fix that.
Yeah, yeah. To your point, Kelly, you're saying like at the end of prologue, I guess it is, where he's captured, and that's it's this very similar CIA Black Ops kind of vibe or story trope where like he has no choice but to kill himself with a cyanide pill, and then you find out that it's all a test. That wasn't actually a sign of it. It was like a whatever knockout. But like, he got tortured the fuck out. Like, the homeboy pulled all his teeth out. Like surreal, like, Russian mafia shit.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like he is, this yes. is, and this end, but the point is to emphasize that he never talked. He never gave up to his crew. So then, yeah, once he comes to, and like, he's like, that's the first thing he says. He's like, he doesn't say, where am I, or, am I right? He's like, where am I, crew? Like, that he's still,
right.
That's how strong his emotion, his empathy is, and like, but also like, just to confirm, like, in case you wasn't clear, this is a hard motherfucker. Like, he is about this life. Like, this is
fuck James Bond.
I mean, shout out to John David because my man's is doing a full on sprint in fucking SWAT gear, and I was just like, my man's is athletic as fuck. Holy shit. You know what I'm saying? I mean, and like ducking under shit during that fight too. Yeah. Like, he does that ill ass slide into coat check. I was like, damn, that's a hot ass. Like, that is a hot ass shot.
That's what I mean. Hell, the whole fight, that whole fight sequence. I mean, again, you're doing a lot of running, but when to have to learn a fight forwards and then how to learn a fight backwards, but it's like backwards. learning how. I can't break like how do you learn how to pull a punch or how to throw a punch backwards? Yeah.
Right. Right.
Think like really wrap your mind around it and doing the physical movement in a fight where you're fighting yourself. Come on, man. Come on.
Like my brain hurts just even trying to conceive of like I can't fight forwards, right?
Yeah, just going to the big props to him as a physical performer. Like, I guess he was a football NFL. Was he NFL or was it like college?
NFL. Yeah, he was NFL.
You don't even think about that raw physicality. It very much reminded me of Carl Weathers back in the day. Action style. Like, you see that Jackson with Carl Weathers? He's chasing a taxi cab. He's running to catch a cab, and he is like going like 3 minute fucking like he is zooming. And so, yeah, it's very similar like this prowess that John David has, and especially like one of the first fights you see in the kitchen where he's like wailing on the goons and like. He is this kind of brawling. He is like, he looks like, slim and he doesn't look huge when posing, right, but like, he's like, no, this guy's all like beef. Like, he's like all about this. Like, you see it as he fights, his whole body's in it. His whole energy isn't like clobbering people. And like, it's really like, again, the movie is kind of, I think you think of it as like a kind of sophisticated or like pristine, type, the classy spy kind of film. But no, this guy's a fucking like marauder.
Yeah, he beat the ass.
I mean, that's like very much the next thing too, is because once he's debriefed, he has to spend time in the windmill. And I remember watching it on IMAX, and I was like, "Oh, my man's is doing pull-ups." And imagine if he slipped, like John David be dead. I was like, "That's crazy." I mean, Nolan has the shirtless shots of him off, or what I mean? Like, I was like, "Yo, he knows what he's doing."
But goddamn.
Yeah.
And that's all he did. Did he only work out in those situations? Because he was doing the pull-ups on the boat, too, later on in the film.
Yeah.
I guess there was no gyms anywhere on that deck, huh? No.
That's how he kills time, baby. Push-ups and pull-ups.
Yeah, there's no equipment. You got to use the boat itself or something like that,
Now, wait. If you're doing pull-ups, but you're inverted in time, do your muscles get smaller?
No, like if you're going for the traps, then your quads will get stronger.
That's what it is. I got you. He came. He was going for the six pack, but them biceps is big as hell. I got you.
Do y'all know why they stashed him in the fucking windmill for a week?
The time switch or whatever.
Yep, they don't want him coming into contact
with anybody
and fucking up. Yeah, and fucking up the mission as it's going on.
Interesting. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Shouts out to Nolan. No, I will say because we're pointing out a lot of details. That's Christopher Nolan. Like, all right, make sure this shit right here. Put this right up. Like, he just the attention to detail on that stuff is why I keep coming.
And
back
then,
to this.
Like, honestly, that was probably the reason a lot of people, and me included, didn't really dig on this movie to begin with because it felt smarter than me, right? Like I felt like an Irishman at a bar. So you think you're better than me? Right.
Well, let's get into that, because like the very next part is him meeting the scientist Barbara, and she straight up tells us, even him and us, like, "Yo, stop thinking about
right,
this shit.
Right,
just go with it.
Go. Catch a vibe.
Don't think, feel it. Yeah, that's the
thing. Don't try to understand it. Feel it.
Yeah, even that. And then I like that. There's like a even with that statement, like, you know, don't like try to analyze it. You still got a good sense of dread. This is just classic, you know, kind of Nolan's filmmaking, you know, like old school. Like, there's still like the dread of, like, even though you don't know what's happening, but there's a mystery about why it's happening. It seems like, you know, they kind of say like the future's trying to fight us. Like, fast, bam. What are we doing?
Like, whose shoes did you step on?
Yeah, so like, even though the threat is kind of vague compared to like a normal like spy slash war film, it's enough that, oh, shit is real. So Denzel Jr., please help us out. Please save the world. Like, you know, get your pull up something. Let's go.
Denzel Jr.
Because I like that. Speaking of your point, I love that shit where he's just like, yo, shit moves backwards in time. Cool, but I don't see the problem here. And she's just like, well, like, look at all this shit. Imagine them building a bomb. Like, and that's when it clicks for him. Like, oh, shit.
He's stuck on like the nuclear aspect. But again, he's like, that's CIA brain. He's not thinking like, he's not thinking tenant right. brain yet.
Right.
Big picture.
But yeah, I wanted to bring in like, if all the sci-fi and time travel stuff kind of turn people off, I felt that one of the strongest parts of the movie is that when it becomes a interracial buddy comedy,
where he meets up with Neo.
Yeah. It kind of becomes like their relationship becomes the heart of the movie. Where it's like, no matter what all this crazy shit going on, as long as these two is together and like getting through it, you know, we'll be okay. You know, us watching this adventure play out, you know, we have the hope that it's gonna pull through. But yeah, he's a really good. People say that John David. He lacks charisma, or he has like wooden charisma, and I don't disagree with that, but I think that his style of acting is on purpose to, like, it's a kind of a very stern, almost his edgy charisma, but like him being like the straight guy is part of what makes it work, but it can't really work unless you have somebody like, you know, what, you know, flamboyant, or like, you know, just very extroverted like Robert Pattinson to play off of. So when he comes in the picture, just being all coolest white boy you've ever seen, like, oh, okay, it kind of works together that way.
And honestly, I totally agree with you, and I see that across John David Washington's like career. Like, whenever he's with somebody else, he's a much better actor, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and his style, like you said, his sort of flatline style. It meshes with anyone else he's with. So in this case, Robert Pattinson being Robert Pattinson, you know, it kind of amplifies that.
Yeah.
Like that performance, and makes it better.
But I also want to say, I think it kind of helps with who they are, though. I mean, throughout it takes a while for the protagonist to even understand, yo, I set this up.
Right.
I did this. Mm-hmm. Like, that's way towards the end. And but because Neil knows everything down to, you know, what he orders at the bar or whatever, when he's trying to be nice and not away, like he has to play a certain cool just to, like, you he can't tell him everything, because if it may compromise what's going on, but he has to still be that guardian angel. So it's a really, like, really dope back and forth, especially because I think with John David Washington's demeanor, however you guys are perfectly describing him, I think that lends to the state of where the character is throughout the film.
And I love that, the description, because it really is like Robert Pattinson is like when someone throws you a surprise party, right? And you got to keep that motherfucker off. Like, you got to.
All right, no, you stay right here.
Right here. I can't tell you why. You know, but,
we're going in the house. Don't worry, we're going in the house. Yeah, he's got to be that guy.
I mean, I appreciate on rewatches John David's performance, because, you know, he's nameless. He's the protagonist, and the one thing I think of now rewatching the movie is Clint Eastwood and the Man with No Name. And how, like, stoic he is, and how he just shows up. You don't know shit about him. He's like, oh, you know what? I ain't really fucking with this. Let me do what I got to do, get paid, and dip.
And, I do appreciate that he has no real backstory, because sometimes I don't care where the things I
like
where you came from.
Yes.
Right? I don't need a tenant prequel of of the protagonist's time in CIA training camp. Like, that doesn't add to anything.
I mean, the way he reacts to situations throughout this movie tells you everything you need to know anyway. Like, he's always cracking jokes. Like, when he meets Michael Caine's character, he's like, oh, y'all got Monopoly on snobbery? Yeah. Like, that shit's funny
as fuck. I ordered my hot sauce an hour ago, which was was an improv line, by the way. When I talked to him, he said, well, everything, it was a blank line. He said, go in and quarterback. And then he said, bet.
All right.
That's what he came up with.
He does the real black shit where he's just like, yo, can I get a to-go box? And the dude looks at him like,
yo.
He's like, this is not an Outback. Look at him like, he look at him all disgusted like.
Like, leave no meal behind. I can have, I can have a bite. It's like, I paid for it. It's coming with me.
Well, in fact,
yo, I'd say fuck Michael Caine, too. I was like, bitch, you started without me? You sitting there eating your nice steak and potatoes, bitch? All right.
He already knew they was under the wire. But also, if I was in international waters going everywhere all the time in nice-ass restaurants, I would get a to-go box everywhere, too.
Everywhere box, too? Yeah. Yeah.
Make me a squad, too, bitch.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. The protagonist is black as hell. He's always saying or doing some black ass shit.
Like, you know, always they say he has like a dry or no humor at all. But I think that's not the case. Mm-hmm. That he's just like so particular and dry. Like, even, you know, the Dark Knight movies or the Batman movies, like, there's not humor in those. It's just like feels so ominous and serious. But he has mad jokes in all the movies, even like in Interstellar, like a lot of them. He's like just like fucking wise. And I like it feels like he uses John David like a he's like the what a stuffy British person thinks a cool black guy is.
He went on Wikipedia and is like, cool black guy.
Yeah, put that right in the chat GPT and made a person. Yeah,
yeah, but, you know, it works for the movie. Like, it works like him being that story. Like, it goes with the vibe. Because, like you said, he can kind of, I guess it kind of works as a agent. Like, he can,
100%.
Being a black agent, like, people want to know you're not from there. But like, he uses his like this that kind of that weird anti-charisma to just kind of like stick it anywhere. So he's still a brother, but he's still like also like he has a certain demeanor that you wouldn't normally think, you wouldn't guess like he's just some like tourist, whatever. Like even like, later on as the movie goes on, where they are he encounters like the wife and the bad guy, like they're like you ain't no fucking travel agent. What would I say? You ain't no art connoisseur. You know what the fuck you are.
Well, yeah,
like,
right.
But at the same time, though, like they're like you don't actually know what he's about. Which is again, that's part of like.
Right.
Mystique, like
he's
obviously somebody, but you can't quite discern what kind of person he is. Because I think it works in his favor. Mm-hmm.
I do like the teaser did clue us in onto what type of character it is. Because I remember the teaser said it's time for a new type of mission, new type of protagonist. And it is true. Priya even says, he's like, yo, if you need to get close to Seder, it's going to be you because nobody knows who you are. And he is. He's infiltrating high society, and he clearly isn't supposed to be there. I mean, he's the only black dude in the room at all times.
He stands out, but yeah, but like a very unique skill for, you know, for agent.
Yes.
The movie, but also the same as the actor and as a character. Like, you know, like he doesn't belong there, but he makes himself belong there. That's how the movie works around him.
Right.
It also brings up another line that cracks me up, was where as he's being debriefed, because he's debriefed by Barbara, which is where he finds out about Inversion. Then he meets the arms dealer, Priya, who at the time we all think is running Tenet. Mm-hmm. And so he finds out, oh, I sold these emissions to Sador. And he meets Sir Michael Caine, which is Priya's contact. And during that, where Sir Michael is telling him, you know, Sator's whole deal and, you know, Kat, the wife Kat, I like how he's like, you have an inflated idea about my seduction tactics. He's like, yo, I'm not Bond. I may be smooth, but I'm not Bond.
Yeah, I like during that kind of those first interactions where he's trying to like infiltrate Sator's kind of circle, and like, well, you know, and Ken Branagh, you know, shout out to him, like he's a, you know, master level actor. He's been around for decades doing big things, directing and acting as well. And he just kind of plays it like just like a straight up cycle, like a cycle, like I said, like a wild Bond villain. He's just like so off. He's like a short fuse, hair trigger kind of personality. And so like, so as it's happening, you expect that here comes, you know, this cool brother coming in. he's gonna fucking lynch him. Like, and they kind of play with that energy. Like, he's so unafraid of Seder, even though this is a high stakes kind of mission. But they kind of make these subtle, somewhat open jokes about him still fucking his wife. With a little bit of that kind of interracial, oh, here comes a big black guy kind of white wife kind of energy to it. They never say that part, but like, you definitely feel he's playing off of that.
It's a vibe, like you said. Yeah. It's a vibe.
It's a vibe.
It's like, oh, he's big black dick coming in.
Jesus Christ. No, that's facts. That's actual facts. Was that what it was? He wanted to blow up the world because he thought his wife was going to mess with a black man. Is that the secret plot behind it?
I've heard worse. I've heard worse plots, actually.
What I like too is like it takes almost a full hour for Seder to finally enter the picture because you have him meeting up everybody because it's so hard to get to this dude. So he keeps going through person contact to contact to contact to get closer. Even his wife, and his wife's just like, I don't got time for this shit. Like, yo, he's going to beat you up and I'm going to be stuck in this shit. And that's where you get, like Vice pointed out, like the dope ass kitchen fight where my man uses a fucking cheese grater on homie's face.
Love that scene.
And that shit in IMAX was tight.
Yeah. You heard it. You heard it. It's great. Oh, man.
Yep. I love it. Yep. You heard that. Damn. Or the one where he straight up punches homie into that, the glass doors. He kicks homie right into the glass doors before the big goon shows back up and he throws him down the stairs, which leads right to the next thing, what she needs from him, which is to get the black, because she's in, what's fucked up about this whole situation, which you think about it on so many levels, Kat just wants her son back, and he's using their son and this forged art painting to keep her in the marriage, which is fucked up on wild levels, just to keep a woman who don't fucking like you, period. Right. And so they go to the Freeport to get this painting back and then to see, yo, what exactly is Seder hiding in here? And that whole shit is wild. Like, they crash a fucking real plane into that building on some 9/11 shit. Like, when I knew this shit was coming up, I remember I was like, yo, before I see it in IMAX, let me just watch it again at home. And I ate an edible, dog. And I remember watching that shit where they crashed the plane right into that building. I was like, bro, how the fuck did he tell the studio? And they said, yeah, go ahead, do that shit on some real 9/11 shit. Like, yo, I'm going to crash this building into a mother. I'm going to crash this motherfucking plane into a building. Now, it's a real plane into a real motherfucking building.
This is what I'm telling you. This is why they had this, like I said earlier, pandemic, they thought this was going to be that shit. However much money they put into that movie again, they crashed a plane into a building. And it wasn't a small plane either. And if you look, it had gold bars and shit flying out. Like, there was a lot going on that plane. They thought they had it.
All for a distraction.
All to get up into a little room where a painting was in.
Hey, but like,
yo, right, I was like, damn, that's y'all.
Nolan thing, right? In the Dark Knight, he blew up a hospital, right? Like, I mean,
Well, that's on some different shit. This is on some like, oh yeah, we need to get in here and we need a distraction. They're like, all right, well, let's crash a plane into a building. Like, and you see his reaction. He's like, yo, why are we gonna do that, bro? We just trying to sneak in. And he's just like I love Robert Pattinson. He's having so much fun. He's like, cause it's cool. You know what I'm saying? It's cool. And they meet up with homie, and homie's like, yeah, that sounds like fun. I'm gonna do that. Like, I'll do it. I'll gladly.
Jeff, you mentioned before that if you kind of imagine this movie without all the version sci-fi shit, like, just on its own, it's still, like, a great Bond movie. Like, this whole kind of first half where, like, they get into the minutiae of the painting and the fake forgeries, her whole deal in the international tax-free zones. Like, all this is, like, Bond plot stuff. Like, it's, like, actual, like, kind of reminds me, what was the second Craig Bond movie?
I dug it.
And, like, it was kind of the same thing there. It's, like, a this is kind of in that movie, this whole big conspiracy, but like in the spoilers, what they're going for is water, like the most precious resource, thirst. Like, right. So this is kind of the big pomp circumstance around the heist or around the plots or the conspiracies for the simple thing. Mm. And here it's like works very similar. Like he has to go through all these hurdles, like to up to that point get to the painting or like, get to the forgery. The forgery, like that by itself, is a pretty cool like concept for a Bond film. Go do all this shit. Go do all this fucking international intrigue to get this like you know expensive thing that's actually fake. Like just by that, that's a pretty cool like you know a setup. And then of course you know the fucking time travel machine.
It's right, and that's why I'm like the time travel is the least interesting part of this movie for me, right?
I don't like know me, about that, really? But I get it. For you, I
so
get
wait.
It.
So let me ask you a question. And I know I'm kind of skipping ahead. The what gives me pause with that is like the entire like end sequence is a whole. You know, we're going backwards and forwards. Like that's the whole key. Were you just done with the film by the time they got to the big bang?
Like I wasn't done with it. I was there. I was watching it, and it. Even when I watched it on TV, that was a great set piece, right?
Right.
That's interesting on its own in a different movie, right? For the movie I started off with,
with Black Bond.
Like with Black Bond, you know, fucking white women stealing patents, right? Right?
I think the movie builds up to that shit, though. You know what I'm saying? But you know what? To Vice's point, too, like, yo, where he's like, they're laying out the plot and shit. Well, that's one of the part of the reasons why I love this movie, too. Because, again, once they start explaining shit, Nolan says, yo, fuck that. And they turn up the music when homie's explaining the Freeport. And you get that fucking hard-ass score where you feel that bass in you as Robert Pattinson's going around the Freeport. You can't hear what they're saying because he's like, yo, don't worry about that shit. This is where they're breaking
this
into.
This is one Nolan's part, kind of his good visual language. Like, you just what's happening is Robert Pattinson's Neil, he's casing the joint. He's observing all the exit points, the camera security. He's casing the joint. But so all that, whatever they're saying is irrelevant. So again, that's like kind of to Nolan's credit. Like, you don't have to worry about what they're saying. Just like follow along what they're looking at. Like, he knows where to put the camera to make you understand, at least in the moment, what's going on. And kind of just that to the movie, you know, from those small things to like, you know, the fucking big ass plane. Like, you kind of get all those stuff just to visuals alone. You don't really need, well, to a certain extent, you don't need the dialogue so much in certain parts of it.
Yeah, especially in the moments where you can't hear shit.
And like, watching it in IMAX, the sound's not better, right? It's just. Mm.
It is at certain points. There's a couple of scenes which we'll get to where I'm just like, yeah, bro, y'all needed a better sound mix. Like,
for me, it was like, just louder so I could understand it better, right? But
because there are points where they're talking, but the music also feels like it's on the same level. That's still there.
Yeah,
gotcha.
And scenes in a couple of scenes. But let me ask y'all this: so they get into Sater's vault, and there's the turnstile, like. Can you imagine what the fuck they're thinking? Where they're just like, bro, I thought we're gonna find some
a nuke,
plutonium and like some and a painting. Like, what the fuck is this? And for two dudes to come out, one going forwards, one going backwards. That's some like, yo, I'd be like, yo, what the fuck did we just stumble upon?
That was kind of. I don't want to like make this full comparison, but you know, Jordan Peele, he's known for like doing these kind of wild sci-fi, also in slash horror kind of elements with movies. Like, you know, things kind of go south quick, and then you kind of get jump scared. That was kind of a jump scare for me when I remember when I first saw it, like, because like they set it up, you know, you see the bullet holes that haven't happened yet, you know, you kind of this is like literally the turning point of the movie where it kind of goes off the rails or into the rails, whatever. That's like, at that point, like, what the fuck is happening? And then, you know, again, the boogeyman come out, and it's like, oh shit, this just got like too real for me. Like, I was like, oh, like. that's when definitively it goes from cool Bond thing to like, oh, sci-fi should go right now. And I like that he says, again the vibe, because again from that the briefing part where she's like, the future's coming to kill us, man, you gotta be careful, it's just crazy. And yes, you kind of see it, at least at the moment you kind of recognize that here's the first tangible evidence of the future coming at us. And they had that brawl.
Yeah.
I was like, yo, what the fuck? Like, I remember I was just kind of like, at that point, I was kind of just stunned in silence because I was like, I have no idea what this was happening. I have no idea what the implications are of this. All I know is I'm scared. I want Denzel Jr. to survive. Denzel, survive! Like, from that point, you start to get to the whole the whole inversion and the whole the time war, as it were. And I don't know. I wonder if people kind of fall off from that point. I think up to that point, this is a cool Bond film, and I wonder. And I guess to jump in quickly. The whole point I heard over the past several years, you kind of see this discussion of I don't get Tenet. I don't understand. And every now and then, there's a viral post happens with she's like, I don't get to see that. If you ever seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, the first of the Bill and Ted movies.
Yeah.
There's a part where they got they're short on time, so they have to get their dad's keys, because dad's a cop. You have to get your keys. You have the keys, mm-hmm. but they don't have time to get it. So they say, wait a minute, after this adventure, after the movie's over, basically, let's go back in time and leave the keys for us. We can find it. And then in that scene, they're thinking out loud what they would do in the future. And then he goes, where would you put the keys? How about right here under the sign? They reach under the sign, the keys are right there. And the point is that in the future, they've already done this, but now we're seeing the causal effect or effectual cause of that. That's what Tenet is. Yeah. Tenet is just that scene in Will Ted. Instead of keys, it's weapons of mass destruction. All it is.
That's how Seder communicates with the future. The dead drops are instantaneous. Mm-hmm. Like, as soon as they bury it in the future, it's in the past for him.
That's crazy.
Right then and there.
So that's why, people always say, it's confusing. I suppose this is all the backwards. No, it's just it's leaving your own time capsule. Leaving your own Google reminder, but with nukes. It's very straightforward, actual things happening. It just feels off because, you saw Denzel find himself. I can call Denzel Jr.
He would hate to hear that. He would hate to hear that.
Don't ever do that.
Don't do that. Don't do it around him.
Do not fight
John David Washington.
I'm sorry.
You heard what he could do with a cheeseburger.
Right.
Shoot. But I'm going to use that whole entire Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure analogy whenever I explain Tenet. Whenever someone's like, I don't get the mechanics of it. It's like, have you ever seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? Like, yeah. All right.
Remember the keys?
Right, the keys. Whoa.
That's funny.
So, Vice, I know you love action movies. You have your whole podcast dedicated to action movies. So, let's just say it. We see this fight twice. How do you feel the fight going forwards? Because I like the fight when it's going backwards through the backwards view.
As actors, performers, and the stunt choreographers, I know actually recently there's kind of a big push to get stunt creators as Oscar nominees. And this is a prime example of a movie that warrants that. And I've seen, they have some of the behind the scenes footage that they released. I might be on the Blu-ray too, but you see them practicing. They're doing this backwards kung fu. Like, they're actually putting the thought into how one would move going backwards, on purpose, intentionally, to move. And so, and the cool thing is that it doesn't just happen that way. They're not just fighting backwards and forwards. You can actually see this, getting credit to John David and the choreography. You see him learning on the fly, I understand how to fight backwards. Yeah. And you actually you see him emote that, and then you see him play it out. I guess the part where he catches he unassembles it, I guess, is kind of the way.
Because we see that in the opening scene where he clue right there.
Again, when you don't know that it's him yet, he sees that happens, and I guess regular time, John David's like, what the fuck has happened? But then in the second phase, in reverse, inverted John David's like, oh, I get it now. I can do the things now. I see the Matrix now. They were able to actually show that, again, with no dialogue, you just see it happening. Even with all the kind of crazy confusion of, first of all, it's just a fight in general. A fight on film can be confusing if you're not done right. They were like, do it, show it being somewhat chaotic, and yet at the same time, have the body language to express the character's emotion. We have the understanding that, I understand now how to fight and whatever happens now. And also, now that we know that he's fighting himself, we understand the kind of, from the previous engagement, why that person, the shadow person, inverted John David, is fighting the way he is. Mm-hmm. He's not, he don't want to kill himself, obviously.
Right. Exactly, right. Exactly.
I mean, I think one thing I noticed on rewatches is when he's this first time we see this fight, it's a little more chaotic and close up, right, just because that's his mind state, right? It's all chaotic and fucking
literally, yeah.
Yo, he's like, what's going on? But then, like, when we see it again and a shot wide and we could see him actually fight, it's because he understands now what the fuck's going on and how he can maneuver.
He got the,
I think that's pretty cool.
It's like in The Last Dragon when he catches the glow. He catches Shoto and just see him with the moves and everything. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He got it. He got it. No, but I think that, and that's the key. And again, going back to John, like you said, John David's performance, that was one of the things he mentioned, was that he specifically didn't want it to look like he knew what he was doing in that first fight. It had to look like he was confused because his character was supposed to be confused, right, because how the fuck do you know how to fight somebody backward? Like, right, you know, but it's upon rewatch. The first time you watch it, like, this is weird. But I think once you may almost have to, like, get a watch or two out of this film out if you're trying to really pick up what's going on. I don't think, because there's no way you can pick up on stuff like that. I didn't pick up on, right, that on the first watch. Mm-hmm. You can't.
Right. I mean, this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. This is definitely, mm-hmm, like, I would say, like, a 3 or 4 watcher just to be able to, like, see all of the levels.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So there's a part, so now we get to the kind of the third act, I guess it was. This is where we kind of discover that we've seen the enemies from the future, and you know, we understand the physical threat now. So then finally we get, like, we discover he's not by himself. The cavalry comes in, and he comes up kick ass. What's his name? Aaron Taylor Johnson comes in.
Oh, Aaron Taylor Johnson.
He comes with, back up and more exposition. Like, yeah, two for one. Like, he gives you, like, first I'm saving ass. Let me see what's going on. And, like, it just, again, now we're fully in sci-fi, like, you know, like sci-fi, like Metal Gear Solid territory. Because we're in the future doing, like, war shit now. And it actually, I remember that when I see his character, like, I don't remember the character's name, but as I'm watching him talk and watching him, like, interact with the protagonist, I'm like, this is Captain Price from Call of Duty. Like, straight up, like, this is, like, full-on character.
Yo, I had that same thought.
That's funny.
Watching this the first time, it's like, is this, like, Call of Duty? Is that the dude?
You know, again, like, and, well, here, so just kind of a spoof tangent. Part of my podcast, you know, actually for everyone, is that we've been, over the years, really kind of talking about the correlation between video games and movies and cinema. Like, not just games, movies about games or adaptations, but, like, the actual language of gaming, we see it in cinema. One example, I mentioned Bond already, like, in the most recent Bond, No Time to Die, there's a scene where he's going up the staircase, like, in one take. He goes up the case, mm-hmm, with guns, and he's, like, taking out enemies. That's basically, like, almost a shot-for-shot of the Metal Gear Solid 1 game, where you gotta go up to the tower to fight the Hind. Like, it's that mm-hmm, same scene. There's a lot of these, you know, even, I think it was 1917, that one-take movie, you know, and, you know, the master, Roger Deakins, doing his, like, his magical, like, cinematography work. That's basically, like, mm-hmm, that's like Call of Duty, like, the first World War One kind of game. Like, it's...
I never thought about that. Wow.
Like, the frames of reference and everything. So, right, yeah, so here, same thing, like, once we're in this Metal Gear Solid territory in the movie, in Tenet, like, it kind of expands that, you know, all the... Right. The tactical jargon, you know, that all the Nazis are talking about, you know, say, like, in a Metal Gear game, you know what they're talking about. Right. Anyway, the Captain Price and all the, you know, all the lieutenant soldiers, you know, all the whole, the red and blue soldiers, like, and then, yeah, and you even see at a point where they have this, the backup now, the whole squad, and he, now John David, now that he's ready for the next phase of the fight, you see him wearing, like, a tactical, like, windbreaker, and he looks like what, in Metal Gear 5, they have the boat, the Outer Heaven, like, their base in the water, and that scene is just like that. They're on the big boat with their virgin machine inside of it, and all of their crew, and he is, in fact, the commander. He doesn't know it yet, but, like, that's what he is. He's big boss. He's big boss who's becoming big boss on this fucking boat with his entourage of troops, like, kind of making the plans for the next part of the future war.
That's crazy.
Like, oh yeah, all this video game stuff that, like, again, like, when you say video game stuff in movies, people kind of scoff at it, like, you know, because it's, people still kind of have this view of it being immature. But, like, no, this is clearly taking that kind of language, that texture of gaming, that wild stuff they could do, and putting it to work, to good use, in cinema. Which is really, really
well done. Right.
Well, right after we're going to rewind it back. Right after the, I get what we call that. Like, it ain't really a heist. It's really like more of a break in and like observe and report type shit. You know, he straight up lies to Kat and is like, yo, so yeah, I got that shit. And she goes back to him and, you know, she's like, yo, listen, I'm getting my kid back. We getting the fuck out of here. I don't like you. I'm going to spit in your food. And he's just like, oh, word? That's how you feel? Enjoy your breakfast. And then there's the painting right there. Mm. And that's why, and that's where I think my man's fucks up. And when she confronts him about it and she's like, yo, now what is he? He's going to do so much more to me now. And that's where I realize, oh, yeah, the look of guilt on that on homie's face when she tells him that. And he sits down on the bed like, oh, fuck, I put this woman and this kid in the middle of this shit. Right. And he hands her the gun and he's just like, yo, only use this when you have to. And she, you know, cocks it and points it at him. And he's like, yo, don't use it on anybody. He's like, just make sure you. But and before that, when he meets Priya, because they walk on the street, they meet in the boat and then they walk in the street. The part in the street where she's telling him like, yo, you can't kill Sater because we got to figure out what exactly he's doing. Mm-hmm. In IMAX, in a theater, I couldn't understand what they're saying just because all the people talking and all the cars going by, the horns honking. I'm like, bro, the ambient sound is louder than the dialogue.
Right.
Was
that particular
part. I'm at a certain point, that's a choice. That's not just
That's
the sound guy mess. But why would you, what's the reasoning behind something like that? Like why as a director do you think Christopher Nolan would want to keep all that in?
I don't know, because they're saying some important shit in that scene. Like John Davis straight up says to Priya, like, yo, I'm gonna take him out. And she's like, No, you can't do that. Right. And I was just like, bro, we need to hear that shit.
That's sort of
though.
Expected from Nolan movies, right? Like, we couldn't understand Bane, right?
True.
We couldn't, like, true. Dunkirk. Mm-hmm. My ears were bleeding, you know? Like,
well, Dunkirk also, the dialogue don't
right,
matter.
But still.
It's just about getting these motherfuckers out of that situation.
Still, like, they wrote the dialogue and people said it, right? Like, I should be able to hear it.
Yeah.
I mean, Oppenheimer really is his best mixed right. movie because you hear all the dialogue in that movie.
Yeah, there is. It's like, except for when he's closing, it's all there is. Like, it's talking. People in the room is talking. So, you know, you can't fuck that up. But actually, I guess part of it, maybe, you mentioned the wife, Kat. And I think when I first saw the movie, my biggest problem with it was I felt like for all this big kind of high concept stuff going on, I didn't quite grasp this kind of low scale of the internal, the big conflict. What it is this abusive husband and his wife and this mental helper. Like all this like doom and gloom about the future war, it's all really his and like this one insecure asshole beating his wife. That's what it. So in my first viewing, it felt like small minded to me. In that, why are you doing all this like big stuff just to have it kind of be anchored by this wife beater guy? Right. But then like,
well, I think that. Go. I think that's also on the point of the editing, because sometimes my man's, as much as I love Nolan, he needs to hold shots more. Like when we see the protagonist go and see, like, oh, she's going to go talk to her kid, and she goes and tries to kiss the kid, and the kid reaches for the nanny instead of her, mm-hmm. and you see the look on his face, like, yo, shit. I was like, yo, you're cutting mm-hmm. too fast. Like, that is a lot of emotional beats there. That you need to like linger on a little bit, my guy.
So to the point you mentioned,
especially since that comes to the end, like the very last thing you see is home little boy finally grab his mom's hand, like, oh yeah, this is my mom, I love her.
So you mentioned like they kind of hit this guilt he has for getting her in trouble, and it kind of what I kind of felt afterwards upon this view is that they're trying to, it's just like the microcosm, the bigger war is just kind of this kind of emotional, kind of like in Godzilla movies, where like a little, the humans are supposed to like represent like the monsters kind of have a tandem emotional journey as humans. That's kind of what I thought was happening. What he was trying to go for is that this big scale like time war stuff is just like it represents the struggle of like, you know, trying to like do right by or woman in crisis where the whole world seems against her and all she needs is like a help, you know, and like
It's a two-pronged mission, right? He's trying to save this woman and her kid while also saving the world.
On the second viewing or later viewings, that did kind of cohere for me more. Like, I appreciated what he was doing. It's still kind of messy, you know, because, like, it's just, well, you know, yeah. It's a, what was the movie with, what's that movie with J-Lo? She had it beat by her husband by Jim Caviezel, Jesus.
Enough.
Like, yeah. So, like, she kind of has her arc like that, where, like, you know, she's a damsel in distress. And then she's like, I've had enough. I'm going to fight back. So that was the actual part of the spy mission. That was cool.
I said the name of the movie, the title of the movie.
Just in case you were confused.
So, you know, he finally gets close to Sater. He finally, like, convinces Sater, like, yo, I need your money to help me fund this mission, which he don't. He's just trying to see how his whole operation works, right, and to get the plutonium away from homie. Leads to probably my favorite set piece of this motherfucker, which is the heist that turns into a car chase, right? Like, that shit's crazy that John David is actually climbing up a fire truck, using the ladder, planting bombs, jumps into the truck, blows that shit up inside, steals the shit, and he has to jump back out of that motherfucker, all while doing a coordinated attack with all these people that they hired, right? Like, all these cars got to box in this safety truck.
Right.
And I love how the security guards are like, yo, the truck's still moving. Ain't shit happening.
Don't worry about that. Don't worry about nothing.
Yeah, don't worry about that. The truck's still moving. We good.
Talk about amazing set pieces. That whole sequence was beautiful. And the fact that that's one of the times, what's the part where he does the countdown and then you see the car start doing the flip, and then he realized, like, that's one of those moments too. Cause I remember seeing that in the trailer, that moment where that car flips like that and being like, all right, that's the what the fuck moment in the trailer. But in the movie, it really makes it real, because again, it's not like the two of them are on a dirt road. This is a whole highway. Like, people are going at regular speeds, and we've got our little time inversion bullshit going on, passing pieces to algorithms across car covers and whatnot. Like, it's a lot, but it's almost amazing that I'm surprised more people didn't die.
my friend who works my podcast, Liam O'Donnell, he's a director. He does these cool, like, these sci-fi movies, the Skyline series, like Skyline, Beyond Skyline,
honestly, I love the Skyline series.
Oh, yeah. He's fucking dope, man. Like, they kind of become, like, these cool, like, martial arts sci-fi ventures. And he was saying, he's actually in the process of the post-production of his latest film, and he was saying that when the process of doing car scenes for action movies, it's funny because, like, it's actually very slow, like, for safety reasons, like, they move it like 15 miles an hour or something like that. Like, a very slow, arduous process. And he doesn't do it because, you know, it's expensive. Like, you get all the shooting hours and whatever, and plus the physical cars. Like, you know. So a lot of the car scenes we see, even though, like, they seem like jam-packed, fast-paced to us, breakneck speed, they're plodding along, getting their shots in the coverage. And so, yeah, again, this is, like, another example of Nolan's great skill. Like, this feels so propulsive. Like, not just propulsive, but precise. The actual motion of the cars, the four, I guess, hauler vehicles capturing the guard vehicle, like, that's so precise, and still he has that sensation of being fast and, like, urgency, this is not many people do this shit. This is a high level effort from Nolan here. Like, it's not just
talk about it.
Yes, man. Because, I mean, this car chase ends, right? Because, like, one. They're going forward. They're being chased by somebody going backwards, and you find out it's Sater holding his wife hostage and leaves her in the car. He's just like, all right, well, here you go. my man's has to jump in. Like, that whole shit is crazy too, because you see the doors keep smashing into each other as they keep getting close to traffic. He's like, fuck. And as soon as he saves her, what happens? They're ambushed again. And that's when, as you know, Vice, you put it, like, hey, yo, we got to call the cavalry. And homie's like, what the fuck are you talking about, cavalry? And I'll be real with you. When he first said, like, yo, you love club soda, not Diet Coke, I would have pulled out a pistol out of my coat jacket and been like, yo, so how do you know that?
Yeah,
like, that's to me, where before we even start the mission, I would have pulled out the, I'd be like, how you know that shit?
You been talking to my ex?
Like, that's not in my dossier
at all.
Yeah, so, you know,
So well, yeah,
next scene. Like, so now we talk about, you know, right after, you know, they get captured and they get saved, and but like right before we can continue, yes, we have to see what just happened in reverse. And so this,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
this is the first time we see the protagonist from our view go inverted. And again, this, again, all this cool magical cinema. Like you said, like I guess like the sound is backwards. The sound is backwards before. So I think they like the sound recorded backwards, played forward, somewhere like that. And so you see him like go into the inverse or whatever.
Yes.
And like, you know, it's just like weird, a whole new world, whatever. And then and we see that car chase in the reverse perspective. And when this happened, I remember for the first time I saw it, you know, the junior doing. Paying homage, Tony Scott, Deja Vu, Denzel Washington, that scene in that movie where he has to, another time inversion kind of thing, is a scene where in that movie where Denzel has to do a car chase with somebody in the past. So he's in the real time in the present in the time car
with the headset and everything.
He can
like
see,
that,
yeah, he can see like 7 days into the past. So on the highway, he's tracking. The guy, other than the bad guy's car, in the past, in real time, well, quote unquote, real time. So you see, like, dodging traffic and shit, but he's not really, but he is. And you know, that shit was just like, I was like, you know, just like your daddy. Like he was doing the same thing. He was driving in reverse, like to catch up to himself. Now that he's inverted, but driving forwards, backwards. You know, I was like, yes, it's like fun, like son.
Yeah.
Do it again. That shit was dope, man.
Yeah, that moment where when he pulls up to the two cars in the car and Sater looks at him and then he looks at the other Denzel Jr. just like, hey, shut the fuck up. Keep going. That little moment was so dope to me. I love that. I loved it.
I'm going to be real with you. I love that shit too, where he first goes out and he steps in that puddle. That shot of him stepping in that puddle.
Yeah. Dope. Yeah.
I also like how everybody's calling him out on his bullshit. Like, yo, what the fuck y'all you doing? Like, let's focus on what we doing here instead of you going back out here. Like,
what is it?
Kick-Ass tells him that. Neil tells him that. Wheeler, she's like, Wheeler's briefing him on how inversion works. Even she's like saying it with like, you really doing this shit? Like, come on, bro.
Yeah, a cowboy shit. Figure it out. Cowboy shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then. You know, Sater blows him up and you find out because the shit's backwards, it actually freezes him.
Crazy.
Don't actually sets him on fire, which is fucking wild.
Yeah. That's
and then you on the boat.
That's when I started wondering about, you know, the pull-ups. Cause he, any matter of fact, he's doing the pull-ups on the boat, if I'm not mistaken, but yeah, his muscles.
That's a little further down the line. Cause now we're still in the boat where they're trying to take Kat cause she got shot with an inverted round. And mind you, that scene where Sater's holding them hostage, a lot of people who watch the movie, that's the part where they're just like, yo, I'm out, bro. Just because Sater's talking backwards,
right.
And then you hear it, and everybody's like, yo, what in the fuck? But I'm like, well, hold on to it, because what I like is as soon as Kick-Ass and Tenet comes in, you see it directly from his point of view, because, you know, he disappears, and he's like, yo, where'd he go? And he's like, yo, the past.
Right.
And then it cuts right to Sater, doing what we just saw, and you could hear everything he's saying. I was like, okay, yeah, because now we're at the point where they are now explaining everything, like what you saw before.
Right.
Now we're going to explain how it's happening and why it's happening.
We're getting the inverse of the confusion from before, and that's why I got like I understand being confused, but I you got to catch a vibe. Like maybe for a while you're supposed to be confused, and then like the protagonist, you figure it out. Because it is really like at this point is when he starts to pick up all the pieces.
Yeah. Yup. And you know, this is another point where like the protagonist and Neil and Kat, they're all together to get Kat to save Kat's life since she's been shot with an inverted round. He tells Neil, like, yo, explain it to her, because, like, yo, this shit, I can't explain this shit. And then when he's asking him later, like, yo, what? And he's like, Neil goes, oh, does your head hurt yet? And he's just like, yeah. He's like, all right, so go to sleep. Like, even, like, the whole movie, my man's just telling you, like, yo, don't think about this shit.
Calm
it's
down.
Just happening.
Calm down.
Yeah,
let it
calm
go.
Down. Calm your ass down and just watch this shit.
Facts.
Oh, then we get back. We find out, like, oh yeah, they put on the fucking the SWAT suit gear, and they're going back inverted to save Kat's life. Mm-hmm. take her to the turnstile, and that's when we get the fight now from him inverted. And I love that shit, especially where he catches homie's hand and you see the look in his eyes when he catches his own hand, like, oh shit, all right.
Also, we're gonna put a reveal that so in the first, the forward phase of that fight in the beginning, you see that Neil stops the future guy, but you don't see what he sees. Now it's clear that he stops the protagonist, and you see that as an action. Mm-hmm. Yep. And now kind of, if it wasn't already 50 before, now it's like fully that Neil is not just more than you see, he's more than he knows, but like he's like that secret birthday party thing. Like he has his own kind of agenda, as it were, where even though he's he's ride or die with the protagonist, he still has to kind of stay on mission and like not reveal too much to the protagonist.
He's going. Without speaking too far ahead, he's low. I mean, I know the protagonist is a protagonist. I don't want to shut a black man down. But Neil's kind of the most important part of the whole organization, like the whole mission. Like he's the one that if he had not done anything at that point, but like, yo, that's you. Like he could have fucked everything up. He just said, nah, take your helmet and go on. Like he needed to be there to kind of keep the sled going down the hill.
I mean, he straight up says, he's like, yo, you're going to let me shoot myself in the face? He's like, no, I wouldn't. And things have to play out exactly as is, because it's like the butterfly effect. We can't change shit, because who knows what happens if we change shit. Mm-hmm. He's like, our job is to suppress this shit. That's why none of us know shit, except for me. And it's me, because you sent me back in time to prevent all this shit from getting out of control. Right. That's why I'm keeping you in the dark. Like, that's pretty fucking cool.
That is cool.
And then he goes and meets Priya again. He's like, yo, Priya, what the fuck, man? Seder has the whole algorithm, because now we know what the algorithm is. It's like, you know, a scientist from the future built this thing that could, you know, reverse time. And she realized, oh, no, this is terrible. And now these cats from the future sent all the parts of the algorithm back in time for Seder to find and blow it up, because shit's so bad in the future that like they just want to be like, all right, let's try to fix it by literally blowing up time. Crazy. Which I was like, and my thinking is, how desperate are these motherfuckers that they're gonna send a time bomb back? I'm like, don't y'all understand that's gonna like finish y'all off too? But then they get into that with the grandfather paradox, because the grandfather paradox, that's the whole point of it. Like, yo, you don't know if you kick grandpa down the stairs, does he die or live? Something.
Explain that shit.
Yeah, I do like the whole thing. I explain during this part where like he's kind of, they're ready for this kind of final assault, because like, part of the plot is that the nuclear location, like the fake Chernobyl that they're going to have this battle in, that's actually kind of stated origin story too. Like, I think at this point they kind of reveal that Seder is he's on borrowed time. So like he's gonna die anyway. Yeah. In this case, it's kind of like it's not just a suicide mission. This is a nihilism mission. And so like it's like the beginning of the war and this guy's all coming together. And I like that when the protagonist kind of realizes what's happening, he says well, what if we do it a little bit differently, and like let's actively fuck with the timeline a little bit, as it were. And she says to him, oh, you're starting to see things differently now. Like he kind of understands how to like not play with time, but like play with, I guess, expectations or whatever. So forget it. Like the fact that they gave Seder the whole algorithm pieces. Like he has all the pieces, but that's what's smarter way to get them all together so that you can take them back by getting somebody who knows where the other pieces are together for you. So like at first they kind of blame Jack. Is like, why did you give them the piece for it? They're like, no, that's a good thing, because now we know where they all are. Now
let's
go fucking get him.
Right.
I like that the motherfucker had to be humbled here too. Like, yo, you use me, and she's like, well, you know, look, did you think you could save the world by yourself? Right. And you see the look on his face, like he stops for a second. He's like, damn,
you're right.
And then he goes, you know what? I can though. Gets his mojo right back. He's like, you know what? I can save the world though.
Well, me and my white friend, we're
gonna
do this thing together.
Yeah, as long as I got my white friend. It's not a problem. We could do anything as long as I got
my white homie. White guy, you can do anything. Yeah, exactly.
The right white
shield of privilege.
I mean, we'll get to it, but I mean, literally, homie does become a shield.
Facts. Literal guardian angel. Yeah, that's what it is.
Right to the grill. Right to the grill. Yeah, so they figure out from he puts together, like, yo, Sir Michael told him, like, yo, a bomb goes off the same day as the opera siege, and that's where they figure out, oh, that's where the bomb's gonna go off. Seder was Kat's there, and she's important because she's like, yo, he's gonna do it, he's gonna kill himself in Vietnam because that's where he's happy last, and he disappeared. Like, she straight up says, like, yo, after that day, he's just gone. Mm-hmm. He disappeared. And we're all just like, what? So we get into now, you know, the big assault, right? Kat's back on the yacht with Seder. They're invading Stalls 12. And as cool as this sequence is, I got to say, homie should have had the Seder's army in different clothes. Because that white clothes they have on, at times I'm like, yo, these motherfuckers are bleeding into the environment.
Yeah, it's about the action, but the scene a little bit, because, like, you know, again, it's like kind of the height of where the forwards, backwards, kind of in the same frame is happening. It's kind of where Nolan's like going full tilt. Mm-hmm. You know, probably the most iconic shot of this portion is where there's a building that gets blown up by, so a time soldier in the past fires a rocket at one part of the building, and a time soldier in the future fires the other part. So at this exact moment in time, when the building blows up in the forward time, and then blows down in past time. But it's like,
that shit's hard.
That shit look cool.
Trying to explain it is hard enough. You're just seeing it, like, how the fuck did he do that? How did you physically get this object, whatever it's like, those scale model, whatever, or maybe it's been real building. Like, how did you get this object in time, in space, to destroy in two different times? Like, that shit was wild. Like, to this day,
I think they did blow up a lot of buildings. I'm pretty sure that, again, I don't quote me, but I think it may have been one of the more expensive set pieces to be filmed for a while. It was a lot of money.
I mean, at this point, Christopher Nolan.
I mean,
might
they
as well,
literally pull.
At this point, he might as well just own a,
I mean, they literally
company.
Facts.
I mean, Vice, I told you this after I saw it. I was like, yo, they literally pull a pincer movement, yes, like a military pincer movement, where you see them surround the enemy. One's going forward, the other's going moving backwards. That shit's crazy. To see that shit, that one shot of them surrounding the enemy, one team going forward, one team going backwards. I was like, bro, that's wild. That shot, I'll never forget seeing that shot. That shot was wild. I was like, they literally are doing a temporal pincer movement.
That's amazing.
Because that is a real military move, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah. Within this big battle, we have even more inversion going on where you see that Neil has to re-invert. You know, because, again, he's on his mission that he can't tell yet. So you have the protagonist going to, you know, do the main mission, get the device. But then it kind of, things go awry. And, like, again, this is where kind of the, I think people are confused, but also, like, I think there's an intent where the characters themselves are confused, because you see in Neil's face, even though he knows what's going to happen, so to speak, he's like, oh, shit, I don't, like, this is off the game plan. Like, he has to, like, kind of scramble.
Right.
Like, kind of to try, he at one point gets to a car trying to warn the protagonist about going into the mine or whatever. Then, like, he has to, like, kind of scramble out of it and, like, figure out a way to get to him, because he knows he's in danger. Not because he knew it, like, from, like, the big scale, because he just saw in the past, in the inverted, immediate inverted past, Jesus Christ, what's about to happen. So he has to re-invert to go back.
He's got to be that cog in the wheel and make sure it keeps going. So that means sometimes you got to double back. Yeah.
Yo, the attention to detail, too, because when he's spying on Seder's people using the turnstile, he touches, like, the railing, and you see the dust fly back up onto the railing when he touches it. Like, I didn't pick up on that until my most recent watch. Right. I'm like, this motherfucker, goddamn, even dust, dog.
Even dust.
Like that simple touch. Yeah. You know, let's get into Kat. and her on the boat stalling Sater.
Her plan.
Yeah.
She
using her awkward feminine wiles.
It was kind of confusing. I mean, she's just like, you know, I'm back. I'm sweeping up whatever. We would clean it up. We're going to have fun. She was right, though. And I think we were all right. No matter how much he wanted to kill himself and the rest of the world, that man was in love with that woman. Mm-hmm. He said, no, we just have a seat. We just chill for a little bit.
Yeah, because he thinks that's the his wife from the past, not the wife that he thought he killed.
Not the wife from now.
And I'm like, how much you love her, too, that you shot her with an inverted bullet, my guy?
Again, it's kind of this microcosm of the fate of the world hinges on this, like, this capricious, stubborn, evil man. Like, he's so insecure about his life and his wife. And, like you know, he's just fucking a sad man. He's a pathetic man. He wants love, but he can't get it. So he kind of accomplishes all like his power and his empire, but he can't get love. So like again, like I guess it's kind of uses that against him in the sense. Like, he's like, I'm trying to finally give him a taste of what he thinks he wants. Love.
Not wait, love, but, you know what you did because you mentioned earlier we were talking about how this film is so weird that it's kind of caught up with current times. Not that this wasn't a current idea, but is he just like the richest incel? Like he's married, so it's kind of different, but like it's the same thing, right? I can't have you; nobody can. Like that's literally, you know, what his plan at a certain point.
That was the working title for the
the richest incel, and they just made it.
You got me. You got me feeling like Stilgar, where I'm like, yo, he's the Listen Al Gaib because the villain is a Russian. He's an incel. He's like, he foresaw it.
He could see it before he even happened. He's like Andrew Tate, Manosphere Bros. He got a big boat in the Pacific. He got all his money. He got his goons. He got what he crypto. Thinks is like, you know, what people should have. But he's miserable. Like, he can't buy
right.
He can't buy love. He can't buy time. You know? So he almost ends all. He's just a pathetic. Even though he's scary and imposing the movie, he's just a pathetic man. Like, I love that Kat kind of finally has the courage in her portion to recognize that and face him as such. You know, she's like, you ain't shit, man. You ain't shit.
I mean, even in when the protagonist and him have their final conversation over the walkie-talkie, he's even like, yo, I'll give my wife your love. And I'm like, this nigga still
nobody cares.
Yeah, bro. I'm like, yo, we in here trying to get this bomb. I don't give a fuck, bro. The last thing I'm thinking about is getting my dick wet when I'm about to be blown up.
Like he's on some cuck hot wife.
Yeah.
You want me to tell you? Want me to tell my wife? He said.
Fucking loser, man. Yeah.
Oh, a loser. Big loser.
Levels.
I do like its pay.
Well, I'll say like this is probably my biggest problem with the Sonics because this might be actually like philosophically most important conversation they have. Like when he fully reveals his nihilism and and this is a part I missed. I gotta go back and read the subtitles. He says Sater tells protagonist that you're a fanatic who doesn't believe. Like there's a lot of and this is coming around to the end at the end of the movie. There's a lot of faith involved in this because you know again like these agents of the time war, they are by intentionally not being told what's happening. They have to kind of figure out what's going on. So they're kind of acting on faith a lot of the time. And, you know, kind of Sater kind of says that. I know, like, to him, it's like, this world is full of shit. There's no God. There's no love. There's nothing. So what are you fighting for so hard for? And he kind of says that. But, like, a lot of that is, like, it's so, like, muffled in the conversation, in the walkie-talkie, like, you don't hear it all.
Right.
But, like, he spits some, like, some deep shit, you know, for incel.
Yeah.
But the protagonist is like, nah, man, I'm trying to fight this dude off me.
Hell yeah.
I mean, the one thing I like to like on my first rewatch, I was tight that John David didn't get to kill Sater because I was like, yo, he's the main villain. He should be able to kill him. But I think I like it better now on rewatches because now that plays into what he said to Kat where he beats the shit out of her, where he's just like, you know, you don't have it in your heart to shoot me. And he tried to play his hand again and she did it. She shot that. Homie, right in the chest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She had enough. That's right. Great.
But like, even on my... That's
and great. Threw him right off the boat where he hits him the railing on the way down.
And like classic. The first watch, I actually enjoyed the ending just because dude died thinking he won. Right?
Yeah.
And that shit makes me like gives me shivers. It's like this motherfucker thought he won.
Oh yeah, because he tells Volkov, his henchman, he's like, yo, shooting him in the head, and then the next thing you hear is the gunshots, but he don't realize, oh, that ain't Volkov shooting him. That is that Neil and the protagonist, right. You know, doing their thing. I also like that on a rewatch, you know, when the protagonist is spying on Sater on his boat, Volkov catches him and pulls some moves on him. That is the same exact moves the protagonist does to take him out at the end of the movie.
Oh, word?
He pulls his own moves on him.
I love that.
To take him out.
I love that. That's smart.
I love that scream too. Oh! He falls down that shaft. Bye, bitch. And he just looks down like, bye, bitch.
Bye, bitch.
Shit. Here's the kind of the critical like endpoint or the final act here is that when Volkov is going to shoot protagonist, he shoots Neil, jumps in and saves the day. And it didn't register at first, but Neil just killed. He sacrificed his life to save the protagonist. Mm-hmm. That's his body. He dies. Like he literally dies on screen. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, through the magic of inversion, that's just one half of the journey, because right. as it continues on, he basically comes back to life. Or in our eyes of the four time frame, he comes back to life and continues mm-hmm. the mission. And I was like, that was like, oh, this is going crazy, man. Like, because this is kind of where it's trying to wrap your head around what's happening. That you just saw this person die. It's an important person. But like, mm-hmm. and he's back, you know. Like again, like,
right?
That's when you have to remember the when. You know what I mean? Like the key to everybody in that story is it's not where they are, it's when mm-hmm. they are. And in his like, we saw just like the movie, we basically saw. You want to talk about a Tenet prequel? This film is basically the Tenet prequel. Like this is how he gets the idea to start the shit, but. The start of the mission is not on screen. That's way out in the future. He's like, fuck, let me send you back. We got to send you. We got to figure all this stuff out. So when you realize that while the protagonist, his story is ending here, Neil's is kind of like around here somewhere, mm-hmm. and he's still got a little bit to go to get back. And so that's when I was like, nah, that's that they Nolan did that shit. I don't care what nobody says. Like, you know, because it was so much for me to sit and really think about it. Because and on a rewatch, I think when I notice how it's almost like an infinite loop. That's what the key to the mention about the grandfather paradox, especially on this last rewatch for me, is like you almost can't think anything but that everything's gonna be fine because everybody's here. Like if something had happened in this mission, we wouldn't have had a film because the shit would have all been blown up. You know what I'm saying? So you like, there's a lot of clues on what you should be thinking about within the film, but it's a concept wrapped up in a couple of really dope spy and heist moments and set pieces, and not, you know, has Christopher Nolan don't know shit about no time travel. He said, he'd been thinking about this for years. The only image that he had and said, I mean, you know, is people make film, you know, you have that one idea and it's not always something you can do. The thought of a bullet being sucked out of somebody's brain and going back into a gun, like that was a concept that he had. And the key, and kind of like how the protagonist, I'm working right now, kind of like how the protagonist goes through this film, Christopher Nolan had to make the Mementos and the Dark Knight trilogies and all that stuff to be like, yo, I can wrap my head around Stalag 12 and fucking temporal pinchers and all like all these movements and all this stuff in this film is because of the last 20 years of his career. To me, to be able to pull this off from a thought of a bullet going back into a gun, even if you think it's a C+ Christopher Nolan film, that's a fire ass C+ film. I don't care what nobody says. Right.
Let me ask y'all this. How tired do y'all think Neil was? Because Neil had to die for him, right? In Stalls 12. Right. On the same day, he also has to be at the opera house and save his ass there. Also had to help him out when he couldn't pick the lock.
Yep.
And he just stares at him like, oh, God damn.
Dog, come on. You broke that shit?
And then fucking when they get ambushed again, he's like, God damn, yo, I need y'all help. We go, come in. And then when he finally shows up and he's like, yo, listen, this is our people. He's like, and he chokes him out to the point where Kick-Ass is like, yo, calm your ass down. We all on the same side. We running this shit. It was just Seder knew the whole time because he's running his own temporal pincer movement.
Right. Yeah. So,
like, I'm like, yo, this guy got to be fucking exhausted because he got to keep inverting himself and then get reinverted right. And then reinvert himself and travel back in time so that way he could get it to the opera house. That's a good ass friend.
Reverse magical Negro.
Facts.
Yeah.
Facts.
That's brilliant.
That's brilliant.
Oh, damn. Shit.
The reverse magical Negro. I have to write that down.
Well, actually, I wanted to say, we're at the end now, and then the kind of the conclusion here at this scene is the day is saved, and then the protagonist and Kick-Ass and Neil have to, like, there's a brief tense moment where they're like, we have the time bomb now. Well, now what? He pulls a gun.
Yeah, and he pulls the gun on him, and he's like, and because, before they go in, the only people who know about the algorithm are Neil, the protagonist, and Kick-Ass. And Kick-Ass tells him, like, yo, nobody leaves the field alive. He's like, that's why it's just me and you being the splinter cell going in there.
Right.
So when he goes and reaches for it, the protagonist is like, oh, fuck, yeah, you did say nobody leaves the field alive. That, he looks scared as shit. He's like, oh, all right, I guess this is it. And then he looks at him, he's like, God damn it. I know you my boss, right? Can't kill you. You my boss. Let me break this shit up. He's like, yo, y'all figure this shit out and whatever. He's like, let me get my ass on this helicopter.
So in this scene, that's
the reveal.
So, you kind of trying to tell the protagonist we is. Now, this is a very, I talked about faith before, like this they're operating on belief. And he says that probably the central tenet of the movie, this line, he says, people operate on fate is like what's happened has happened. That's not an excuse to do nothing. It's an expression of faith in the universe. What he's saying is what's happened has happened. Like when we say that, we're affirming that what we do will have an effect. So he's saying that even though with all this time bullshit, even though we quote unquote know what's going to happen, you still have to act. We still have to do. So, were saying, like, he's exhausted. He had to go back in time, like, five different times. Go be in two places at once, literally. Like he's understood that even with this whole paradoxes and all this bullshit, you have to actually do. There was a cartoon back in the day, 90s, Mighty Max. I love my favorite cartoon back when I was a kid.
I love Mighty Max.
And a part of the whole purpose that, this kid has a magical hat that has portals around the world. He has the finest evil dude in on the middle of Earth.
That show's fire.
Yeah, but near the end of that series, you learn that the his guardian, whatever, this like talking chicken guy, the guardian actually has known what's going to happen throughout the whole series. He has a destiny wall, whatever. And he said this stuck with me for years. He says, destiny is part fate, part free will. Like, even whatever is meant to be will be. But even with that, like, there's a being, there's a doing. You have to have the doing part. You have to actually act. So none of this, as we're seeing the movie, this is all almost preordained. But at one point, again, when protagonist kind of opens his eyes, he realizes that I have to actively work this system. I have to work time to make this come together. Like, I can't just be absent and things will work out. What happens then is the end of the world. So yeah, I thought that was just so kind of profound in a way that he's saying that even it applies to the movie internally, but just to anything. No matter what situation you're in, even if you think you have no power, you have a power. Like, your own will is something. Your own will is part of this destiny chain. It's part of time and space, whatever. Like, you have to act. So yeah, I just thought it was really cool that he said that, because all this confusing time bullshit. That doesn't matter. What matters is you see them doing man of action shit. Like, none of this would have happened. None of this, nothing would have been resolved if they didn't man up and do it. I love that part.
yeah, everything will work out, but you still got to do the work.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
I mean, Vice, to play into your point, I mean, that's the whole point of the movies. The protagonist has to learn that, like, whatever's happened, happened. Like, you cannot change shit.
Right.
But that also doesn't mean you don't have to stand idly by. Like, he's a man of action, and I get that. Like, he just can't stand by. But also, you need to learn when to step in and when not to step in. And if shit happened, you can't change that shit. You just got to keep moving forward. I think that's a good way to live life. Like, whatever's happened, happened. We'll keep moving forward.
100%.
I mean, let's get into this last scene where, you know, he asks Priya. He's like, yo, don't kill her. Like, yo, she has a kid. Like, give me your word. And she reneged on his word. And homie opens the door, shoots her bodyguard, and then shoots her because he's like, yo, you lied, bitch. Like, straight up, you lied to me. He's like, and she's like, yeah, you knew my word wasn't good for shit. And
she
he's
told
like,
all right, well, I'm an Indian arms dealer. Like, what did you expect?
Exactly.
Yo, giving it to the most dangerous person on earth, right? Giving selling bullets to the most dangerous person on earth.
Like, you don't become the richest person in India, right, without
right.
It's... Yo, real quick, can we talk about how dope that shit was where he has Priya's husband, the gun to his head, and then he puts the hand over it to prevent the blood splatter? Like, yo, now I just want to threaten people like that all the time. Be like, oh, word? You won't? All right. Yeah, hell yeah.
That's like minimal.
That's the most gangster shit I've ever seen.
That's like really minimal splat. Like, all that shit is still, right. You get hit it with something at some point, but it does look cool as fuck. It does look cool.
But yeah, also the hand, just to go back, the hand gesture throughout the movie to let people know, like, yo, Tenet, like, that is dope. And then for Neil to explain it, it also means the flow of time coming together. That's it. Yeah. Yeah, he explains that when they traveling back.
I forgot.
Yeah, about. Man. And then the Travis Scott fucking song kicks in. That shit was loud. Fucking IMAX. But
I bet it was.
It was dope. It was dope because the whole theater just sat there and listened to the shit, like, nodding their heads. I was like, oh, we all vibing this. Seeing this movie with a sold-out crowd, I was just like, man, y'all fucked up with this movie, y'all. Because motherfuckers stood up and clapped when it was over. I was like, oh, people like it.
It did kind of feel like, I don't have any, like, stake in the movie, but, like, it did kind of feel like a vindication. And that, like, this was this happens after Oppenheimer. So people, by this point, people know that this guy can sell anything. Like, he made a three-hour movie about people talking in a room, but it's a fucking phenomenal blockbuster that moves like a fucking action movie. So I think that it was just kind of a nice, like, I guess victory lap is what you call it. Like, right. People could finally see Tenet in its true form, with how it's meant to be, and with this full, with the full context of what Nolan, who he is, what he can do, you know, Oscar winner for the director now, like, you could appreciate this on its own terms and not be worried about the fucking, not be worried about being confused or worry about, like, this strange type of blockbuster that's really an unusual spy fiction thing. He's like, it's a Nolan picture, you know, with Denzel Jr. and the boy from Twilight. It's fun. You got fun with it. You get all that nonsense. It's don't think, feel it. And people finally got to do that. They finally had to feel it.
They caught a vibe.
I mean, I think Oppenheimer makes this shit better, bro, just because thematically, they both the same. Like, they both trying to say the same fucking thing about nuclear weapons and free will and, like, you know, the dichotomy of man and our decisions that we make. And in addition, what I like about it, too, is rewatching Tenet is I think Oppenheimer is one of the best edited movies I've seen. Like, the edits in that motherfucker are amazing. Mm-hmm. And Jennifer Lame, going back and seeing Jennifer Lame's work in Tenet, I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I appreciate this the first time. She is really putting in work in the editing, too. Like, they are even stylistically
similar.
Yeah, man. Like, yo, they should do IMAX double features for both of these motherfuckers.
They may.
Be real with you.
If people, because I think the other thing is, you know, because the theaters have been down, the talk has been, oh, we need to hype these theaters. We got to do this. I feel like we're going to get more of this type of stuff. Not necessarily stuff that it was out in the pandemic years. I didn't really get to hit theaters, but I think in general, like we're about to hit the Ghostbusters Gremlins 40th anniversary soon. I wouldn't be surprised if one of them hits theaters again. Like it's they got to do it. And I think there's no better way to honor this, especially when you piss them off. Nolan got pissed that day when they said they were putting all the movies on HBO Max for a year. He hated that shit. He hated that shit. You got to do something. He
leaves Warner Brothers and then wins Oscars and makes the most highest grossing movies career. So like
they said, don't
go back to Warner Brothers is what I'm trying to say.
Warner Brothers said, we get something back. We're going to get some of this.
Well, you know what? Interstellar turns 10 this year in November. And the rumor is that they're going to do a really big re-release for that motherfucker too.
I could see it. I could totally see it.
Listen, I'll go see that shit again too, because that shit is fucking hard.
I'd love to go see AMC theaters. I'd love to go see it near my house, but y'all just got a building sitting over there that's collecting dust for some reason.
Let's not talk about that, man. Let's not talk about that.
Every 6 months I have to. Every 6 months I have to.
Like
every time
kills my soul.
I see. Oh, we're losing money this quarter, and I have to tweet them like, "Hey, you know what would bring some money in this area? That goddamn theater with the 24 screens with Dolby's and IMAX. Nothing.
It's turnkey. It's literally just clean it up, open it back up.
That's the blame the landlord. They fucking make the rent so high that a fucking corporation's like, yo, we can't even afford to have this.
He's definitely not making any money now. Right.
Right. They lost everything. Right?
So like you lower your rent.
Oh, again, blame the landlord.
I know what I'm saying. Like,
but you know what, Chris? Come up. I'll take you. Come up and see Interstellar on the real IMAX.
I got
your mind be blown.
I gotta go in the 8-story IMAX or whatever up there. What was the last movie I saw in IMAX? Was it Nope?
Damn. Nope was hard in IMAX. Nope was
I'm so glad I saw that. When the white people getting beat up on that TV stage show stage, I was in there. I'm saying, no, don't get that blood on me. I had my hand up like, nah, block it. I love that in IMAX. Sheesh.
Oh, shit. So what overall, how y'all feel about the movie?
I'm much better. Like I said, after the initial viewing was kind of cold on it a little bit, but after all this time, especially now, like I said, after this victory lap for Nolan and movies in general, I guess movies are back, as they say. It feels like it's kind of rightfully claimed its place in canon. Like I mentioned, like I study war films. Like this is like one of the best war films of the 21st century to me. Like it's a really great spy film of the 21st century to me. As an action kind of tour, same thing. This is like next level action. Yeah.
As a Christopher Nolan fan, I love this film. And it's more
first fight.
I'm sorry.
This is the revolutionary stuff going on here.
No, 100%. 100%. And when I think that's kind of the key, right? It's not a safe film at all. And I think it was his 11th film. Like, you know, you expect people to kind of spread their wings and fly, but I mean, not on, you know, this weird of a plane. But I think that's the beauty of being Christopher Nolan. You can have these ideas. You can say, we want to bring out some new talent, some black talent, give them a little spy movie, heist movie situation, and also try and, you know, fuck your brain up for 2.5 hours. I don't know. It's a fun film to just kind of throw on and experience. But if you're confused and you want to figure it out, you got to take a good 3 or 4 viewings to really be like, understand. I mean, you probably get it on the second viewing, but to really see what's going on, I think you really have to give it a couple of runs.
I like
and that's what pisses me off is like, yo, I like, once you understand it, you're like, oh, this is a simple ass story.
Yes. You know, very much so.
I
like the movie better now with some distance and after seeing it large. I still don't love it, right? But I will agree that it is a good film. It's just not a good film to me, right? Like, I can appreciate that it's why people enjoy it, and what I like about it, I really like about it.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a big hour, 45-minute cut of this movie, with all the time sticks cut out, just have the spy shit going on.
it's just a couple of heists. That's great. That would be amazing.
I really came around because I remember hating this motherfucker. But I think that's also partially because I was pissed at both Warner Brothers and Nolan, because I'm like, yo, y'all are playing with people's lives here, and for this shit, right. But now point. Seeing it, you know, as it's meant to be seen, and I understand what's going on, I'm like, yeah, I love this shit. And like, man, I hope he does a sequel to this. Like, I want to see more adventures of the protagonist. See, because, yo, Neil even says, he's like, yo, we get up into more shit and it's fun and you're going to love it. And I'm just like, all right, let's see the rest of this shit.
Right.
Like, let's go now. Like, I'm ready for more adventures of Neil and the protagonist doing some weird time cop shit. I know there's other villains we could fight. You know what I mean? Like, we got, I know they got, bring in Grubers. Bring in some, like, German Grubers. Let's fuck up some German Grubers. You know what I'm saying?
Put it on. I mean, at this point, while he's still on this earth, you gotta have Denzel Prime as future protagonist.
Hell
yeah.
So him
I never thought about that. Doing
things as a protagonist, like, Ultra or whatever, protagonist Maestro. Yeah, it's like, you know, help, you know, protagonist Alpha or whatever. So him and his boy of same blood, of same flesh, of same time.
Right.
Yeah,
that's the movie by itself.
Yeah, because we talked about this, Vice. Like, me and you talked about this where we're like, yo, let's get the future one where we got Tom Cruise as future Neil and Denzel as fucking older protagonist. And then you do it like Godfather Part 2 where you got them younger on the other mission. Have it be parallel. Y'all motherfuckers need to, I remember us talking about that. I was we eating burgers and shit.
Y'all motherfuckers need to stop talking right now. You give away all the secrets.
Nolan, get at us.
I did. There. I want to ask. There's one theory, and I don't know how deep y'all got into the theories at all. Vice, I don't know, but there's one theory that says that Kat's son was Neil. Have y'all heard about that? Y'all buy into that at all?
Yeah, I don't fuck with that. It's so flimsy.
It's very flimsy, and I think it's one of those things where like you would only really get any joy out of that if you got that emotion when he's like taking care of his mom after she like when I watched it now trying to think is that his mom? And even then they don't really play into like a loving caress of the cheek or like making sure she's really secure. He's taking care of her like anybody else, in my opinion.
Right. And like,
the internet, that's what the internet
is
all
for. The part is that, so we keep saying time travel. It's not actually time travel. So what we're seeing, you know, like this inversion of time where Neil goes back and forth, that's happening in like, well, if you imagine a person aging in real time, he only has this span of his lifetime where he's like this, you know, this, well, I guess he's 30 year old man doing this stuff. He can't actually, well, as far as we can tell from the explanation of the movie, you can't actually go back in time to when you were like a kid or whatever, like
a child. Yeah,
Neil still exists in the same time frame as that boy. Like he can't go back beyond himself. You know, whatever.
That's a little too deep.
Right. And honestly, like if the theory holds true, then he saw his mom get shot and like in the stomach by his dad.
It was just chilling.
Right, like, and no reaction, right?
That's cool.
Yeah, that's cool.
You all right, Mom? Let me go help you out. Yeah.
That's you know what? Point. Y'all making a, and this is my thing, that's one thing I hate about the internet. I'm like, yo, y'all make complicated movies, more complicated, for no fucking reason, y'all. Like, just calm your ass down. Like, now I feel like Christopher Nolan. Calm your ass down, just sit down and watch the fucking movie.
Right.
The
fuck
there's only 100%. One fan theory that's actually, I approve of, and that's that James Bond is a code name.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the only one. Like, so it's like Carl's looking with, all right, so once you get to a certain level of spy, they change your name to James Bond 007.
It's like the Dread Pirate Roberts. Right. It's just you just you start calling yourself that.
Yeah.
I'm with it. I'm with you.
Exactly. With you. You know, so that's how they can justify having all these different types, like all these different Bonds, because it's not one dude. It's
you just become James Bond,
right? You're just like, all right.
But you can't stay like if you got to die out or something, right, like if you leave you got to die as James Bond to stay James Bond. Like if you leave the organization, you just back to Manny or whatever. I'm not James Bond. I'm Manny Jones. Like, is that how it works?
Oh shit!
Just questions I have. I'm sorry. These are just questions I have. I apologize.
Oh shit!
My fault. I'm sorry.
Manny, you with the shape up.
Forget black water.
Get, beer for years.
Get Manny was here from Fremont. From up in the Bronx. That's Fremont right there.
Manny Bond. Let's go. Next film. That'll be the next one. No.
Yo, I just want to say real quick, I guarantee you they're going to re-release this shit again because that 1 week was not enough. And not enough. Motherfuckers tried to see that in this 1 week re-release. And I'm like, yo, y'all going to... The schedule is light for this year because right. of the strikes. So, like, y'all got to... And they made mad money off this shit. Like, they made $1 million off this re-release. And it only played in, like, 25 right. theaters. So, right. Yeah, re-release this shit.
They will. They're desperate. They're making street corner moves. Like, a hand job for $5 moves. You know, like, they're...
The we'll Craigslist moves.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah.
The real scumbag shit where it's like BBJ fucking
Yeah.
No raincoat. Yeah. All right. Y'all go ahead and promote yourselves.
Vice, you wanna go first?
Oh sure, yeah. So like I said before, I'm on my own podcast, it's Action for Everyone. You can find us on Spotify, Anchor, World Podcast Star, me and my friend Michael Scott and Lee O'Donnell. We talk about action films, and you know, the whole premise is like, you know, kind of action movies have kind of traditionally been quote unquote conservative bent, you know, like a kind of macho 80s white man kind of thing going on. So we our whole goal is like to show that it's more than just that. There's all kinds of people involved in action movies and who are featured in action movies. So we do a lot of stuff like that. So you can find us on wherever you find podcasts. I find myself. I'm on Instagram at MyFitnessLookingHot. I'm on Letterboxd, my reviews. I have a new review of Tenet on Letterboxd because I'm there being smart. And as always, till one of us dies, I'm on Twitter at Vice Victus talking all this shit.
Nice. I'm at Cal on Twitter, at CalDub on Instagram. I used to have a podcast about movies, rest in peace of my time at Complex, but I do work at The Ringer now, and every Wednesday I'm on the Ringer Wrestling Show feed with my homies Brian, H. Waters and Ben Cruz talking wrestling. I'll be waking up and doing that tomorrow morning. And I'm also editing stuff over there every now and again. But yeah, at Cal on Twitter, at CalDub on Instagram. That's it. If you see me in the street, don't say nothing.
All right, and that is episode 118.
We're the Film Blurreds. I'm Brandon Norwood, and I'm the motherfucking protagonist.
I'm the protagonist.
I'm Jeff Stewart, a.k.a. He Who Remains.
Don't come at us. It's just fucking movies.
You've been listening to the Film Blurs podcast.
Man, I just love what you guys do, man.
I never miss an episode. It's the best. It's my favorite podcast.
Follow Jeff on IG on MindFireXL and Brandon on Twitter at BJNTweets.